Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we return to explore climate, disaster, and resilience, the power of law, politics, and community. With unprecedented global warming, wealth disparities, and peak everything, there is no question that we need to act now to meet the power, heating, and transportation needs of growing populations, and to do so sustainably, equitably, and democratically. What are the obstacles? What are the possible solutions? How do we build resilient communities? With us on this live panel are four experts. Steve Matthewman is a professor of sociology at the University of Auckland, and he's the author of Disasters, Risks, and Revelation, Making Sense of Our Times. Julie MacArthur also joins us. She's a senior lecturer in politics and international relations, also at the University of Auckland. She's the author of Empowering Electricity, Cooperatives, Sustainability, and Power Sector Reform in Canada. Prue Taylor joins us. She's a senior lecturer in environmental and planning law at the University of Auckland, deputy director at the New Zealand Center for Environmental Law, and the author of An Ecological Approach to International Law, Responding to the Challenges of Climate Change. Manuel Vallée is a lecturer in environmental sociology at the University of Auckland. He's co-author of Resilience, Environmental Justice, and the City. Welcome to all four of you, very esteemed panel. Thank you so much for being with us here. So I thought we should start with, what is the big picture in terms of climate, energy, disaster, and resilience? Let's start with the problem itself. Let's start on the end, Steve Matthewman.
Quite clearly, the evidence is incontrovertible that we're living in an era in which disasters are increasing in scale, scope, frequency, cost, and severity. And I don't think anyone is going to deny that. So we are faced with massive problems. And we've also been talking about maybe moving out of the Holocene and entering the Anthropocene. You know, this will take us into historically uncharted territory that as a species, we're now having a geological impact on the planet. So I think the problems are massive and they're real. And some of the problem is that people in political power are denying that those problems are there or real. And, you know, so we've got a lot of climate change denial. But even if you wanted to deny climate change, and I think that's at the forefront of our considerations, what's driving that in the main is fossil fuel usage. And fossil fuels are non-renewable, and they pollute when they're used. And there's no one denying that, even if they want to deny climate change. So my interest is very similar to Julie's, that we're interested in getting to the heart of the problem as we see it, which is transitioning from fossil fuels to an economy based on renewables.
Julie MacArthur.
Last year, 2016, was the hottest year on record since record keeping began, you know, by 1.3 degrees hotter. You know, and this keeps happening year after year. So I keep reading these articles about, you know, how to deal with the news and not become depressed. We have a global scale collective action problem, basically, where we have all of these different nation states and people contributing to activities that are heating up the planet, that are causing increasing droughts and storms and cyclones and all of these other things. And at the same time, we've had 20 years of solid evidence being built and such a failure in terms of political and policy action. Now, one of the challenges as I see it is that this is not uniform across countries. So some countries obviously are doing better than others at this. So one of the challenges is to identify the places where it is working and the mechanisms that are actually working to decarbonize our transport and power systems. In a place like New Zealand, you can't talk about climate change without talking about agriculture and agricultural emissions. So the OECD just had a report on New Zealand's environment that came out, I think, just this month, just a couple weeks ago, saying New Zealand is now the highest emitter when it comes to the percentage of emissions that come from agriculture. Ireland's in number two. It's almost half the emission. So there's this global level challenge around the planet heating up and the climate effects of that and the disasters that that is provoking for people in flooded areas or drought-ridden areas. But then how many actual sectors of the economy this affects? This is transport, this is food, this is agriculture, this is housing, this is energy, this is so much of our system that we have to transform. And I think just the scale of that is overwhelming.
Prue Taylor.
Thank you. From my perspective as a lawyer, and I've been working on climate change now for 30 years, when I look at the problem, a few things come to mind. One is deep uncertainty. There is a lot of uncertainty that we have to confront when we're trying to analyze what is ahead of us. And it's very, very difficult when you're trying to analyze problems and then respond to problems to actually get a grip of the magnitude of uncertainty that we're dealing with. So, for example, when talking to scientists dealing with climate change adaptation, they've been working for a very long time, some of them on 1 meter sea level rise over the next 100 to 50 years. Well, now they're realizing that the magnitude of uncertainty in that, you know, in what we're facing, it could be anything from 1 meter to 6 meters. So how do you develop responses when you're dealing with that deep, deep uncertainty? And no matter what you do, you probably feel that it's inadequate. It's not coping with elements that you haven't thought about. So it creates a lot of anxiety in people, like, what do we know is going to happen? How do we respond to it? Another aspect of the problem that we're facing that I think a lot about is complexity. And as Julie was saying, the problem is incredibly complex. Therefore, the solutions to it are very complex. And we have a tendency in society to try and boil things down into sort of simple ways of grappling and understanding problems. And that's just not adequate. We have to learn to deal with complexity. We have to learn to not shy away from complexity. And we have to learn to talk to experts and communities and politicians and people who don't want to listen and those that have very preconceived views. So when it comes to complexity, I think a lot about communication and how we communicate. And then my third thought when thinking about the problems that we face is soft denial. And that I would characterize as thinking we're doing a whole lot, but actually we're not really coming to grips with the urgency and the magnitude of the problem. And a classic example of that is New Zealand's ETS. That is fiddling while Rome burns. And there are a lot of ETSs around the world that are really just soft forms of denial. They make us feel good that we're doing something. And we essentially just continue what we're doing, but at an accelerated rate. So those would be my sort of three ideas about the problem that we're
facing.
Before
we move on, Prue Taylor, you said the ETS, but for people who don't know what that is, could you just say what that is?
It's an emissions trading scheme. So it's a cap and trade system where you basically buy a permit to emit a certain level of emissions, and then you can on-sell that, or you can return it, or you can buy it on the international market. There are lots of configurations. But it actually, at its most simple level, it is a license to pollute, or I've heard it described as buying a pardon.
And then one last thing, based on what you said, you were talking about the difference in potential sea level rise. What would be the impact if it was this much versus this much? What are we talking about?
I don't think anybody really knows, actually, because along with complexity, there's the interconnectedness of everything. So actually, I think we have to acknowledge there's a hell of a lot we don't know, but actually we're confronted with a problem that is designed for us not to solve because it is so difficult to get our heads around. But I think that, you know, we do have to start doing things. We can't just wait until we feel that we know what we're doing. We actually have to start moving and really, really rapidly, knowing that we're going to make a lot of mistakes along the way. But that's the situation that we're in.
Manuel Valle.
Thank you. You've done a really great job of identifying a lot of the problems with the issue. I wish I had some slides. I think pictures are worth 1,000 words. And last week in my environmental sociology class, I showed some slides to my students about the situation in the United States and a couple places. So my wife's from Louisiana, and it's low-lying area, and 30% of the state's projected to be underwater within a few decades. As a lot of people have heard, Miami, south of Florida, they've all also projected to be underwater pretty soon, actually a lot sooner than I thought. I just saw the latest forecast, and between now and 2050, it's projected that most of South Florida is going to be gone. And there's some patches of Miami that will remain on a best case scenario if carbon intensive carbon measures are taken on board now. The majority of Miami will be gone if none of those measures are adopted. And at the moment, they're having storms just regular storms, not even as strong as this, and they're having backups of water up to people's ankles. And it's a big issue, and they're spending millions upon millions of dollars about figuring out how to build barriers to protect the city from the rising sea levels, spending money on millions of dollars and trying to raise the sidewalks to counterbalance the rising sea levels. And they're not the only city. New York's undergoing the same thing. And in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, there's actually engineers, people who are trying to adapt to the situation, who are seriously talking about building a dam across the Golden Gate Bridge area and transforming the Bay Area into a lake, because there's so much prime real estate to be saved. So these are kind of the solutions. They're willing to spend all this money into these solutions as opposed to dealing with the source of the problem, which is part of the problem. The political intransigence is another big part of the problem. So I have a friend who's in the solar industry, and yesterday he sent an email talking about a case in Nevada. Nevada has been a fast-growing area for solar industry, and the governor was just elected, and he's an industry insider, and of course he gutted the regulations that were making the solar industry profitable industry for Nevada, and the industry's just disappeared overnight. So we've got some major political problems. And then I think the other source of the problem, something I've been looking at more and more closely, is universities. What are we doing? So there's been a lot of talk, and you'll look at our sustainability program website, this really slick marketing program or package that says a lot about how we're greening operations. That point is debatable about how much we're actually greening the operations. But when it comes to the curriculum, we're doing very little to actually provide environmental literacy to our graduates. And this is not just isolated here. In 2001, a survey was done of United States, North American tertiary institutions, and only 8% required their students to take a course on environmental awareness or sustainability. Only 8%. We've got a long way to go. There's been a rise in environmental courses, environmental degrees. Those areas have boomed, but those are electives. And so if you have the majority of people graduating without a deep eco-literacy, it's going to be that much harder to sway them to change behaviors, to support measures, to bring about legislation that will help counter the problem. And for me, I think universities are the epicenter of the problem. They're helping to reproduce, perpetuate the addiction to growth that is channeling, that is driving the problems.
Before we go back to Steve Matthewman, there was a phrase that you used in your book that I thought would be important to talk about, because it deals with the who's actually going to be affected more than others. And the phrase you used was climate injustice. How would you explain that for us?
If you look at what happened with Hurricane Katrina with New Orleans, not everyone was equally affected by that hurricane. It was disproportionately the people, lower class, working class people, and people of color who were living in the Ninth Ward, the lower lying areas. The rich people in New Orleans, they live in the high ground. They were protected. So the issues of rising sea level will not impact everyone the same. And so there's the massive climate injustices at play. And there's some cities who are developing climate adaptation plans, but those too have to be seen through an environmental justice lens, because those plans don't help everyone equally.
Steve Matthewman.
I'll pick up on some other points. Obviously, we're dealing with fundamentally political problems. As I see it, I mean, there's an obviously a temporal problem, and that is that we're dealing with creatures called politicians, and they can think for 3 years. But it's very difficult for a politician to think beyond an electoral cycle. So I think, you know, we have to put some pretty strong pressure on them. I think there's also a spatial dimension to the political problem as well, is that by definition, environmental problems do not respect political boundaries. So we're dealing with things that drift across borders and entire regions. And so then we have to think about global political cooperation. I think a specifically neoliberal problem, though maybe in question time, it'd be fun to think more broadly about an economic problem. But we're in an era in which, I mean, we can define neoliberalism in lots of different ways, but I think a defining element of neoliberalism is that the state is subservient to the corporation. And there's some deep problems with that. One is that the corporation is the ultimate externalizing machine. So any cost it can externalize, it will. And so it'll treat things like air and water as free goods and pollute at will. And also, if we monetize those and look at the full costs, then a lot of the industries that are doing the gravest damage to our environment right now, and I'm thinking about things like big coal, make no money. They make money for big coal, but when you do the full cost accounting on it, they're typically an order of magnitude more expensive than they are profitable, but they don't pay the costs. Human beings pay the costs, families, communities, environments, insurers, healthcare systems. states, the federal government. So if you look at full cost accounting of big coal in the coal states in America, it's not worth it. It's not worth it in a straight economic sense, but we do our accountancy in very strange ways. So all those costs are put on other people. So that's a massive problem as well. It is, I think, at some level also a personal problem, and that's that climate change, I think, forces on us a very strange politics, that most politics is coming together and agitating for more, and more resources, and more gains, and more recognition, and all of these things. For us in wealthy parts of the world, this is a politics of disavowal and less. I mean, Julie and others have made the point that these issues are very unevenly distributed. It's absolutely true. So to take a specific energy example, I'm interested in electrical energy. The Dallas Cowboys football stadium on game day uses more electricity than all of Liberia. So should we be telling Liberians you need to consume less? No. Should we be thinking we should consume less? Yeah. So that's a bit of an issue there. And just to reinforce Manuel's point, because my main background is in disaster studies, I don't think anyone in disaster studies believes in the concept of a natural disaster. They believe in natural hazards. There are earthquakes, there are floods, there are hurricanes, but whether hazards then lead to full-blown disasters is simply a matter of how society is structured and arranged. And there's over a century of the sociology of disasters, and the empirical evidence is clear and consistent that it's the young, the elderly, the weak, the poor, the marginal that get hammered first. So it's very convenient, and Manuel fully knows this, in terms of Hurricane Katrina. Oh, it's a Category 5 hurricane. It wasn't coastal inundation. It wasn't the hurricane that flooded it. It was a collapse of the levee system. The order of repair of that levee system was index-linked to the value of the people and, more importantly, the property behind it. So the areas that flooded were where the urban African-American poor were, where black people were.
Steve, before we pass it on to Julie MacArthur, one of the things that you write about is sort of these blackouts that we're going to be dealing with, and you suggest they're going to get much worse.
Well, I think in a business as usual model, they will, because we live with the myth of infinite energy and infinite resources. And if you think about the way in which, I mean, Manuel was given a university example. When I started at university, it was 100 years ago, we wrote everything by hand. We didn't have computers. We sent letters to each other. We had an internal mail system. Now we read on tablets, we send emails, everything's organized electronically. So we have more and more plug-in devices. As wealth rises, the more and more consumer goods, and a typical issue we have is that luxuries become necessities. The first house I ever had, sorry to rub it in, if you're young, you'll never get one, you know, had a meat safe in it because people didn't have fridges. And one of the problems is, yeah, we get more energy efficient with our little technologies, but, you know, people didn't have any fridge. Now we have two or three. It's the old Jevons paradox that, you know, we're up in our consumption things. Sorry, I can't even remember your question now.
I think you answered it. Julie MacArthur, what would you add?
A couple of things, actually. So there is a whole literature emerging, and Manuel was mentioning, I think, environmental justice or climate justice. So even narrowing down just to energy justice and energy democracy. And Ben Sovacool just wrote, he's one of the people cite a lot on this, but people are starting to unpack what that actually means. So one of the issues is not everyone's affected equally. Not everyone has access to power. And we need to think about that power in terms of electrical power. But then there's a more procedural side of justice. So like, who has access to control what systems get built? Not just does it work when you turn the light on, but do you have control over that system? And that is something that people are starting to research more into. So who are the decision makers? How representative are they? Are there mechanisms for people to control what happens in their local area? And this gets more to the resilience discussion, right? When things go wrong. Because if it is people who are disproportionately benefiting and are not climate exposed in the same way, they're going to be making very different policy decisions than people who are maybe not necessarily not as illiterate or not as energy literate, but there are wide disparities in resources and knowledge and power in this sector that are really important. I also wanted to pick up on what Prue was talking about with this soft denial, which I think is incredibly important. So some of the research I've been doing has been looking at New Zealand's energy policy dynamics over the last kind of 40, 50 years. One of the things I've found in my research over and over again is that in New Zealand, there's this attitude that New Zealand's already clean and green. When it comes to the electricity sector specifically, 80% renewables, you know, this is trumpeted, so we don't have a lot to do in this sector. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is really problematic is that this has allowed a significant decrease in policy action. Action in terms of electrifying the vehicle fleets, action in terms of road transport and public transport innovations that reduce the massive increase in transport emissions in this country. So the soft denial side is coming from this idea that we're generally okay, we're one of the good ones, whereas I think New Zealand has the second highest per capita greenhouse gas emissions in the OECD. Now, a lot of that is agriculture-based, but these other sectors, not just the percentage of renewables, but the other things that need to be changed. So very, very fuel-efficient fleet here in terms of private vehicles and the trucks and all of this, which need to be electrified, which would then require a massive build-out of new infrastructure. New generation infrastructure, new battery storage technology, new transmission, which requires financing, policy support. I mean, the scale of the challenge is very high, but it's certainly not impossible, and other places are doing it. The last point I wanted to make is when you're doing the long-term research, often we assume what is has always been, not necessarily social scientists, but sometimes, you know, people from other fields. And when I was looking at OECD data for a number of different countries starting in 1960, New Zealand actually had a higher percentage of renewable electricity generation in 1960 than it does today. It was at 85% back then, largely due to massive public work spending to build hydro infrastructure. And as the policy regime has changed, you know, we don't want the government to be in the business of actively building things. We want to leave that to the market. We have a very different profile. So a reduction in the share of hydro, a build out of geothermal, but basically, it has gone down if you look far enough back. But like with most analysis of graphs, your starting point matters, whether you get
so
an uptick
or
a downtick.
When you trace that back, can you actually note what the factors were driving it? And I know we've been talking about this sort of neoliberal regime. Was there a particular shift in the government at a certain point when it started to make the trend in the wrong direction?
Yes. One of the big changes I found is actually post-2009 in the policy scenario. So there was a big change in terms of the kinds of policies that shifted to more voluntarist policies. So the government not saying you have to do it this way, but, you know, we're going to encourage activity by providing information, less financial support that's directly targeted to building capacity for new infrastructure and things like that. Generally speaking, most countries, New Zealand was not alone in this, actually having a smaller share of renewables post-1960, countries like Canada and others, shifting to other fuels. So the cheapness, basically, after kind of the 1970s, 80s, a lot of countries developed new fossil fuel generation resources. So that displaced earlier, let's say, old-style wind turbines in Denmark, which then they developed again in the late 80s. So it was development of other cheaper resources coming in that we're not taking into account the full costs of those resources, right? This idea of paying what it actually costs society for the health impacts, the environmental impacts, wasn't there. So big development of coal generation and natural gas generation and that changed those balances.
And those were subsidized, so it's not like they were cheaper at the beginning either.
Through the 70s and 80s. And one of the other big things that comes into this discussion is the development of nuclear power. That also took off, so some people put that in the low carbon emitting, but not necessarily renewable. So there's a debate about where nuclear sits. But yeah, things have definitely changed. So what can be developed can also be broken down and dismantled. And I think that's very important from a social science and law perspective to think about that things are not like on some onward march towards more green or efficient or resilient.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the politics of climate, disaster, and resilience.
Prue Taylor, in your book, you wrote about how law is actually a problem here, especially with what Steve Mathewman was just talking about in terms of international law, because it's lots of states. We deal with state sovereignty. How would you help us understand that?
Maybe through telling a story, actually, is probably, you know, a really good way of talking about it. At the end of last year, I spent a couple of months in London at the Grantham Institute for Environment and Climate Change at the London School of Economics, and it's considered one of the world's preeminent climate change policy institutes. and I was there just after everybody came back from the Marrakesh negotiations, which were the big treaty negotiations that followed from Paris. So we're talking about, you know, the ongoing treaty negotiations for climate change responses. And when I was listening to the presentations made by people who, many of these people had been going to these climate change negotiations for 15 years, so they were absolute experts. And they'd been to the Copenhagen negotiations in 2009, which collapsed. And then everybody kind of worked themselves up to for more successful negotiations. And the Paris Agreement was supposed to be the apex of, aren't we all wonderful? We can all agree and we can save the world together. But what they were saying when they came back from Marrakesh was a lot of the good intention that sat behind the legal framework that is the Paris Agreement had evaporated by the time they got to Marrakesh. And then they started talking about, you know, you hear a lot in the corridors actually when you overhear and then you shoulder tap people like, what's really going on? And they said to me, they had basically been imbued with the idea that the international community and all of those people who go to the climate change negotiations, the state representatives, the policy people, the whole entourage, there's kind of an agreement between them all now that anything is a good outcome. In other words, they cannot leave negotiations now with a failure of the scale of Copenhagen. So it's almost as if everybody agrees that no matter what happens at these negotiations, it has to be presented as successful. And when I heard that, I was completely gobsmacked because there is no way to fudge this. There is a global carbon budget and there are deep inequities and inequalities in the way we're currently using that carbon budget. And the science of what we face when we go beyond 1.5 or 2 degrees is certain. So how can it be that legions of intelligent people who are spending their lives developing this policy can have this tacit agreement between them that they won't talk about what really is the reality, that the Paris Agreement really has no hard binding legal requirements in it. Now, there's lots of discussion about is it a top-down, bottom-up, blah, blah, blah. Ultimately, the essential element is that every state has to come up with a kind of, it's called an NDC, which is a nationally determined contribution, not commitment, to what they want to achieve on climate change mitigation. They just have to do one and they kind of have to generally say, this is my bid for what I as a country will do to keep within this warming limit. But beyond that, they don't actually have to achieve it. There's no outcome if they don't achieve it. Equally, they don't have to prove to us how their contribution is a fair contribution to keeping within 1.5 or 2 degrees. They can just pick a figure and base that on what their economy will wear. So they don't actually have to link it to that target. And worse still, they don't have to establish how it is that their commitment is fair and equitable. There is no ethics requirement there. There's no justice requirement there that's legally binding. And so, you know, when states often talk about their nationally determined contributions, they do it through an economic rationality that obscures the fact that there are huge justice issues. And they do that quite deliberately. And that it's sort of like a distraction that then we all start to talk as society and as politically active people or as communities, we start to talk about, oh, what can the economy wear? Or what does this? We start arguing the counterfactual when actually we should be arguing what are the values here? What are the ethics? We should have open discussions about that. And also what is economically realistic and what is the transition? That's a little bit of a story, but it really comes back to a very basic fact about nation states that we all know, that they are completely free in an international legal system to negotiate what they will do or what they won't do on the basis of their national self-interest. They do not have to take into account the common good. They still don't, and they don't. And how we get to that point is a fundamental issue. But that's how I would analyze a very, very key element of this.
So perhaps we should end by looking at solutions, looking at resilience. Where do we go from here? Manuel?
You know, kind of following up on what I mentioned earlier, I think universities are a key point. Universities are not just impactful with their ecological footprint, but they exert an incredible ideological impact. They're training the next generation. They're giving a new belief systems, the rituals, the practices, the behaviors, the value systems that are going to be moving forward in the future generations. And so for me, one of the things that needs to change is that. And universities have to step it up. Right now, they're greening their operations, but their curriculum is still brown. And we're not doing enough, not nearly enough. And of course, the political economy frame would say that will make sense. You know, they're willing to actually decrease their cost of operations through greening because there is a business case to be made for greening their operations. But when it comes to curriculum, Marx said it, the dominant ideology in any era is going to be the ideology of the ruling class. We're in a capitalist political economy. So that needs to change. Having said that, there's a lot of hope for change in terms of just that particular issue. I've been looking at curriculum greening for chemistry. And in Oregon, they're one of the leaders in curriculum greening for chemistry, and there was initially some opposition when one of the people I interviewed for my research project, he was one of the forerunners, and he decided to pilot one of his classes with green chemistry, and out of the 16 tutorials, they picked one that was going to have the green chemistry component for the lab. And the students were at first completely opposed to it because they were, well, how is this going to impact my ability to do well on the MCAT, the medical exams, because a lot of pre-med students were taking it. And so there was massive opposition. And then it took them 2 weeks where the instructor had to go into the tutorial and say, look, you guys are actually benefiting. You're getting cutting edge chemistry. And after 2 weeks, they got on board. The students understood it. And then word spread. And then next semester, everybody wanted to be in the green chemistry lab, and they didn't have enough labs. So students can be a driver for change. And I got an email from University of Vermont. They're one of the few schools, public schools, where they require their students to pass some sustainability course. And it wasn't the administrators who pushed it through. It wasn't the academic staff. It was the students. I think also in terms of governance, one of the problems is most of the democratic systems are with a small d, where we show up at the polls once every 3 or 4 years, and we think that's our political action. In countries with a big D democracy, participatory democracy, the casting of the ballot is the end point of the political cycle. The start of the political cycle is actually organizing with people and having discussions and then coming out with putting pressure on politicians and so on and so forth. And you have some models, you look at Switzerland, you know, as opposed to other countries that have a hard time deciding what they're going to do over the next 12 months, Switzerland, they've got 5, 10, 25, 50, 100-year plans where they take into consideration what's going to be the impact of our decisions for the future generations. You have Porto Alegre, where they have a participatory democracy model where you have the citizens who are organized by communities, and every community, I think it's 100 communities, neighborhoods are required every year to meet together, come up with a wish list of the things that they want changed in their city. Then they submit that wish list to the mayor. The mayor has to respect the order of the request. Can't fund all of it, but he or she has to respect the order. And then that budget is not ratified until it goes back to all the communities and they put their stamp of approval on it. So there's different systems of governance that we could be using that would give we, the people, much more impact in the decisions being made, not just the decisions that are going to impact us, but the future generations.
Julie, I think this is the place where we should bring you in because you've been studying what communities actually do to develop their own co-op energy. What have you seen in Canada? What do you see here?
Yeah, so I've been studying Canada historically and now moving to New Zealand and then the UK and Denmark. And when I started this blurb on what's wrong, I mean, it is really important to recognize that there are lots of places where really exciting activity is taking place. So for example, in Canada, there are more than 200, 250 cooperatives. So people who have joined together who have decided to build their own wind turbines or solar arrays when they found that the government wasn't actually moving quickly enough in this. I started actually this research, though, looking for community action independent of government, and then as I progressed in the research, found that the most successful places where this is not just some tiny little niche of local actors doing their own thing is where there's actual policy support for it. So that is absolutely crucial, right? So there are some provinces, the province of Ontario in Canada, for example, which in response to learning that took place from Canadians after they traveled to Germany and Denmark, passed policies that said if local people democratically own and invest in these projects and make decisions about where things are sited, which means they're likely to actually be built rather than just, you know, proposed and then they don't end up being financed or there's a lot of opposition, they will get an extra payment in terms of cents per kilowatt hour. And what that means is local economic redevelopment. It means that the people who are proximate to the project are actually interested in it succeeding, who monitor it, and there's a whole amount of kind of energy literacy and learning that takes place. But this was prompted to go back one level in Germany and Denmark in the 1970s, their district heating system was developed based on a law that the government passed to say heating systems are going to be developed on a nonprofit basis. This is not an area of activity. It's too important, and we want to make sure that this is not a place where people's rates are through the roof to enrich a particular organization or other group. District heating, by the way, is where if you have a lot of intensive development in Auckland, let's say, you would have a system of, let's say, recirculating the heat from building to building. There's an island off the coast of Denmark called Samsø, and they are one of the kind of 100% renewable energy island they talk about. But one of the things that they were doing with even cows and dairying, when the milk comes out of the cows, and I immediately thought this would be amazing for New Zealand, right? It's quite warm. And in order to process it, they need to reduce the temperature of the milk coming out. So they put the milk through a heat exchange, which takes the heat from the milk out and saves it in a hot water boiler that gets recirculated to heat the floors of buildings. And in New Zealand, we have serious issues with heating buildings, energy efficient buildings. There are so many different interventions that communities have been at the forefront of, but those communities need to be doing that together. This can't just be, okay, there are a bunch of upper middle class people in a town that is well resourced that are building things so that they're resilient. This has to be about far more than that. So that's where the research is progressing to see how much we can scale up these initiatives and how we can get policies and governments on board with a more democratic, more resilient sector. But it is a really significant challenge, but there are lots of places where this is starting to take place now. So it's actually pretty exciting.
Steve Matthewman, what would you add?
Well, several things. I agree with all of that as well. There's plenty of resources for hope in this country and internationally, specifically around renewable energy. We're blessed with natural capital. We have the best wind energy resources in the world. It's usually sunny somewhere at any point in time. We were, as far as I can tell, 100% renewable at one point. So we are unique in terms of across time we've got less renewable. That's Ben Sovacool made that point in the peer-reviewed literature. But we can be 100% renewable again pretty quickly with existing technology, right? We don't need to invent newfangled technology to save us that'll come from the future. It's here now. So we can do this. And it's a question of political will, obviously. But like the history of energy transition shows us this again, it's not resource depletion that forces change. It's political action. So, you know, the steam age didn't end because we ran out of steam. And I don't think the fossil age will end because we run out of fossil fuels. And, you know, battery storage technology is coming on in leaps and bounds, wind turbine technology, everything, you know. So all of these points highly favorable. I would also say that international cooperation is not impossible. The hole in the ozone layer is closing. That's a great international cooperation story. And some things that often we denigrate, like slacktivism, which I suspect is just a shorthand way of picking on young people. You know, oh, they're all lazy, they stay home, they do nothing. Well, firstly, that's not true. But the other thing is clicking on web links works. You know, I got invited to click on something the other day, and I did, asking, you know, Auckland City Council to divest from fossil fuels, and thought, wow, maybe I should do more about that. By that afternoon, it's like, congratulations, thanks to you. I'm sure it was a couple other people involved. Auckland City Council is divesting in fossil fuels, you know. And so what these things show is very clearly is that you get enough people together, We're actual consumers, potential or actual voters. We can do anything. And I think the history of the world shows us that in empirical abundance, that lots of people come together with a will and a purpose and a single target, and good things happen.
Last word, Prue Taylor.
I would agree with everything that's been said, except that I would say ozone depletion is a very, very different global problem. And a lot of people point to ozone depletion and suggest that it's a success and it's a precedent for responding to climate change. But these are very, very different problems. With ozone depletion, there were very quick and easy solutions to it through changing the chemical composition of a whole lot of appliances. It really actually wasn't really a big deal to respond to ozone depletion. A global cooperation is absolutely possible and it has to happen. I mean, I wouldn't suggest that we abandon any hope of that, but it's not going to happen with nation states, with us allowing nation states to continue to behave the way they are. That's quite clear. I think we've gone backwards, not forwards, in recent years on that. In terms of solutions, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently, having been working on climate change for such a long time and sometimes even abandoning it myself because I get so depressed and I just think nothing's happening, and then I go away and work on the law of the sea and then I come back to climate change. One thing I've been pondering on a lot is, how is it that after all of these years we still don't have a massive social movement around climate change? And in fact, in more recent years, climate change has become more and more technical, more and more the domain of experts to talk about, almost less and less relatable to people's lives in many ways. And so I think a solution lies in us grappling with that and finding ways of dealing with that. So why is it that last night I had a conversation with a policy analyst from Wellington who said, New Zealanders don't care about climate change. Look at the fact that none of the key political parties are really addressing climate change very prominently through their platforms and their policies. So he was arguing that New Zealanders don't care about climate change. And I was saying, well, no, actually all the polls show that New Zealanders really, really do care about climate change. And so we're having this really silly yo-yo argument about, well, if they really did, why don't New Zealanders do something about it? And that caused me to reflect on why it is that we are allowing the current situation to remain. In very simple terms, we currently have a government that has centralized control over policy and law and responses on mitigation. They control it. Local government can do very little directly on climate change mitigation. Yet local government and therefore communities have to bear all of the risk of climate change adaptation. So we've got this massive disjunct. So I think looking for solutions, we have to confront those kinds of disjuncts.
It is a joy to host you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Steve Matthewman is a professor of sociology at the University of Auckland, and he's the author of Disasters, Risks, and Revelation, Making Sense of Our Times. Julie MacArthur, she's a senior lecturer in politics and international relations, also at the University of Auckland. She's the author of Empowering Electricity, Cooperatives, Sustainability, and Power Sector Reform in Canada. Prue Taylor is a senior lecturer in environmental and planning law at the University of Auckland, deputy director at the New Zealand Center for Environmental Law, and the author of An Ecological Approach to International Law, Responding to the Challenges of Climate Change. Manuel Valle is a lecturer in environmental sociology at the University of Auckland. He's co-author of Resilience, Environmental Justice, and the City. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. For many years, scientists and philosophers have explored how much human behavior is programmed and how much is actually free will. But now there's another factor parasites. Parasites have been found to change animal behaviors, sometimes quite drastically. What does that mean for human behavior? Dixon DePommier is with us. He is a microbiologist, ecologist, and emeritus professor at Columbia University. His books include The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, and People, Parasites, and Plowshares, Learning from Our Body's Most Terrifying Invaders. Patrick House also joins us. He's a neuroscientist at Stanford University and the author of a key paper about how one parasite makes rodents lose their fear of cats. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Dr. DePommier, I would like to start with kind of the basics on the relationship of parasites to animal behavior. I understand parasites feed on their hosts, but sometimes they drive the behaviors of their hosts. What are some examples of this?
Absolutely. There are lots of them. In fact, there are many more to be discovered since we have only recently, I think, come to realize that nature has a series of interlocking behaviors associated with systems that tend to reinforce each other. So parasitism is a system. I don't mean to sound highfalutin on this, but everybody has a basic concept of what an ecosystem is. And if you can imagine all the plants and animals that live within a given region that could be defined as an ecosystem, virtually all those animals and plants that you can see turn out to be what we would call free-living animals or plants. If you look inside them, however, you will find that they have a collection of other organisms. Some of them are good, like the organisms that live inside our intestinal tract, for instance, the bacteria, and some of the viruses as well. But there are other organisms called parasites, which are there to take advantage of these, what we would call successful systems. So in order to do that, of course, these parasites have to be able to get from one host to another. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them alter the behavior of their hosts in order to ensure the fact that they'll be transmitted from one animal or one plant to another. And you asked me for examples. I'll just give you the one that I find the most fascinating. It involves a parasite called Spirometramansinoides. It's a tapeworm. And this tapeworm lives inside the small intestinal tract of cats and other felines like, bobcats and panthers and tigers and things of this sort. In order to catch this tapeworm, the cat or feline has to catch another animal and eat it because the parasite has a stage that lives inside the other animal. Well, it turns out that most of these other animals that cats have to catch in order to eat turn out to be either snakes or fish or amphibians. And they're usually pretty fast, especially the amphibians. They tend to jump and hide. You know, they crawl up trees and they escape from their predators, which is the cat. But this particular parasite secretes something. We think we know what it is now. Something into its what we would call the host that will give the cat the parasite, in this case a frog, that makes the frog grow uncontrollably so that the frog actually gets bigger and slower and more sluggish, just like we would get if we were to eat too much and become obese. These obese frogs containing the stage that the cat needs to catch in order to get the tapeworm become very easy for the cats to catch. And so as a result, the parasite has modified the behavior of the stage of the infection that the cat needs to come in contact with in order to complete the life cycle.
I read about one parasite that actually rewires an ant's brain, its neurons, and then kind of hijacks its body.
That's correct. So that the ant becomes eaten by something else, and then that gives that something else the stage of the parasite that it needs to go on with its life. That's true for a lot of associations that you can find in nature. The more you look for them, the more you find them.
How often do you see this kind of behavior alterations in higher-level animals? What about human beings?
I'm not a psychiatrist, nor am I a psychologist. I'm a parasitologist. The examples that I could give you from nature's enormous volumes of stories along these lines is the one that I think maybe Patrick House could be better to explain with regards to, I believe you're referring to Toxoplasma gondii, which is a protozoan parasite. And in fact, it's probably the most widely distributed infectious agent on the planet. Not only does it infect all mammals, but it infects most of the cells inside of most mammals. So it's almost a universal parasite. John Boothroyd, who also works at Stanford, He almost is convinced that this, in many cases, is not a parasite, but rather is a symbiont. And
rather a what? That, I'm sorry, say that again?
A symbiont.
A symbiont.
That actually helps in some ways to stimulate the immune system and to keep the organisms alive long enough to allow these parasites to be transmitted to other animals over long distances. That becomes a strategy. I mean, a parasite might want to keep its host alive for a long time in order to move away from the source of infection so that other animals can also become infected. So we have these strategies that parasites have evolved as well.
Patrick House, let's bring you in. You have been studying this particular parasite, and one of your findings pertains to how it changes the behavior of rats and makes them more vulnerable to their predators, cats. What happens?
One of the interesting things is that if you actually look at this broad range of parasites that manipulate their host behavior, you actually find most of them in insects. So it'll change the behavior of maybe an ant or maybe a cricket. There are examples of these particular ones. Also, I believe a cockroach. There's one wasp that will actually inject something into a cockroach. But if you think about it, on the level of complexity, these are actually rather simple organisms, insects. I mean, they don't have brains per se as we define them. And what I think makes this particular Toxoplasma parasite interesting is that actually it's one of very few things, if not the only thing that we know of, that actually gets into mammalian brains, sits there, and doesn't actually end up killing the host. This idea that the parasite may actually be sitting in the brain for years, months, kind of across the vast majority of the host's life is interesting, because then you can ask, well, what, if any, possible changes in behavior are there? Because, you know, the brain is the seat of a lot of these, of what we consider to be will. So this particular parasite has to get and can only sexually reproduce. And by sexually, I mean it can only combine its genes around inside the cat. So again, we have cat as an origin for one of the most interesting things in kind of this manipulation hypothesis for parasites. So the parasite is actually stuck in a cat. It has to get from one cat to another cat. How does it do that? It doesn't have legs of its own. And it uses rats and mice and other intermediate hosts to actually ferry itself, to kind of taxi from one cat to the other cat. And what we think is happening is that it's getting into the brain of these rats and somehow making it such that that individual rat is more likely to then get eaten by the cat, which passes on the parasite. And my work has shown, when I looked in the brains of the rats that had this parasite and exposed them to a cat, it actually looked similar to when we took an uninfected male rat, and exposed it to a female rat. Well, one possibility is that you're making them less afraid of the cat, and another possibility is that you're actually making them attracted to the cat. So what I showed is that maybe there's some hint that what's actually happening is this parasite is making these rats actually attracted to the smell of cats.
Which then makes them prey.
Which then makes them spend more time where cats are, which then makes them more likely to get eaten. I mean, there's a very good reason that rats and mice alike, anything that a cat, you know, predates, is quite afraid of the smell of a cat because it means imminent doom.
This really does raise the question whether or not we have free will. There's certainly the evolutionary aspect anyway, certain programming, but now we're talking about microorganisms having effect over animal behavior. This particular parasite, Patrick House, that you've been studying is also present in people. What's the scope of the presence and how does it affect people that we know of?
Estimates are maybe a fifth to a third of the world, entire world, all 6, 7, I don't know how many there are anymore, 6 or 7 billion people. So it is one of definitely the most common parasites in the world. And you might then ask, if you're getting into numbers that large, at what point we can even really figure out what, if anything, this parasite's doing. So people mostly get it, we believe, through eating raw meat. The parasite ends up in a lot of different animals, a lot of different mammals, including cows, sheep, pigs, goats, everything that we eat. And in countries that seem to eat more raw meat, you tend to get higher infection rates. So France and Brazil, steak tartare, Brazilian barbecues, things like that, you actually have some of the highest rates in the world in these two countries. Another possible route is through cat ownership. So the parasite is actually transmitted through the cat poop. If you clean your litter box well and don't clean your hands well afterwards, people can often ingest it that way. We definitely know that people have it in their brains. And the question is, what, if anything, is it doing? So even if we know that it's changing rat behavior, that gives us no certain indicator that it's changing human behavior, because our brains are, they're similar in some respects, but they're very, very different in many. One of the interesting things is, well, you have the parasite sitting in a rat brain for maybe a few months, maybe a few years. They don't live very long. But when you have it in a human, and you have it in a human for decades, is it possible that something is coming out, some perturbation is happening that is just very difficult to recognize? So we really don't know. I mean, if you go into a doctor's office and you have toxoplasma, just the parasite, you just test for the parasite and you do have it, you can do a blood test and they'll tell you. That doctor will do nothing special for you. You are not considered sick. There's no, that's not a disease in and of itself. So right now, clinically, there's no consequence to having the parasite.
One of the illnesses that I saw had a correlation with this particular toxoplasma was schizophrenia.
Yes.
Do we know if the correlation means anything yet?
I want to make two caveats to what I just said, which is that it is very dangerous as a in two cases. One being if you're immunocompromised. So in HIV patients, for example, which is one way that a human can become immunocompromised, toxoplasmosis, which is the actual clinical version, can be fatal. In addition, it can be very, very bad for fetuses. If a pregnant woman picks up the parasite for the first time, the same way that the parasite gets into our brain, it can actually get into the baby's brain. So there are circumstances. I didn't mean to say that it was just a harmless parasite. As to the kind of correlations with mental illness, so this is one of the most, one of the most interesting things about this, and really the reason I'm studying it. And what I would say is that we know, for instance, for just with schizophrenia, that there are people with schizophrenia that do not have this parasite, and there are people with this parasite that do not have schizophrenia. So it's not a one-to-one link. By no means will it turn out. I mean, many, many more people have the parasite in the world, like I said, maybe up to a third, than do schizophrenia. But it's one of these really tricky things where we don't really know what causes schizophrenia to begin with, and we don't really know what this parasite does. So when you're asking about the correlation between the two, you're really asking to kind of make a link between two things we don't know much about. And it's the kind of strongest link that we have out there is maybe around 50, between 50 and 60 studies now have shown that if you have schizophrenia, you're more likely to have this parasite. That's certainly interesting. Like, that's the first nugget of, you know, how scientific hypotheses develop. And now we have to investigate that further. But it's quite likely that actually what could happen, maybe, just as an example, people with schizophrenia tend to have poor hygiene, tend to take less good care of themselves. And that could actually lend to maybe undercooking your meat or not washing your hands, or, you know, schizophrenia can make you more likely to pick up the parasite.
Let me thank you, Patrick House, and let me also thank Dixon DePommier.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.